Good evening, buonasera. The Law Department of the London School of Economics launches tonight a new initiative to be known as the Comparative Law and Social Theory Lectures, to be held at this college during the next few years. The aim of this particular project is to bring to the school a number of junior and senior scholars from various paths of life and fields of research, so not only the law, and willing to address issues of a global interest, reflecting on how we think about different legal systems and traditions, or else how those systems and traditions think about us. This is an ambitious project, but we intend to provide a truly pluralistic forum that should allow guest lecturers to contribute substantially to certain ongoing debates concerning matters as varied as action versus system, globalization, convergence of the European systems of private law, human rights in the private sphere, sustainable theories of justice in increasing multicultural societies, and the so-called Eastern values. It is within this context that we are very pleased tonight to welcome Stefano Rodotà, currently a professor of civil law at the University of Rome I La Sapienza and chairman of the Italian Privacy Protection Commission. Rodotà's name is a dear one to many Italians, as well as a bit of an irritating one to others. Rodotà's academic profile is one of a first-rate scholar. One need only mention, perhaps, that in the 7 years between 1990 and 1997, he has published, if I'm not wrong, some 6 new books and edited a 7th. In such books, the author discusses matters ranging from property in post-reunification Italy, the juridification of the body, personal identity, transactionalism, privacy, and generally the impact of today's technology on contemporary society, its members, and their institutions. Rodotà's main concern with those themes is not, however, simply academic. In a small section of his 1992 book entitled Repertorio di Fine Secolo, he clearly, if implicitly, styles himself as a mixture between a pure and a practical moralist, and adds, quote, "It is necessary to rethink, for what they are today, the links between personal and social action, interests and values, behaviors and rules." Page 259, translation is mine. Hence, Rodotà's continuous and continuing commitment to public life, where he has served the national and international communities in several different, often prestigious, and always demanding capacities. Among other things, he's a member of the Advisory Group for the Ethics of Biotechnology of the European Commission, and also former president of the Italian Democratic Party of the Left. The possibilities of representative democracy in today's world can be therefore quite accurately, I think, described as the relentless focus of Rodotà's lucid scrutiny of contemporary society, both as an academic and as a politician. Tonight's lecture is entitled Privacy, Identity and Citizenship. So will you please join me in welcoming here Professor Stefano Rodotà.
It's for me a great honor and an opportunity to have the possibility to speak here about one of the more controversial and complicated subjects of the coming age. I thank very much London School of Economics, and particularly Professor Gunther Teubner and Igor Stramignoni for his generous, maybe too generous, presentation. And I start with two questions. Are we suffering or risking a privacy imperialism, or the democratic state must accept a genuine data assetism? Will we use the use of personal data be regulated more and more by the market-driven forces only, or it will be rooted in the tradition of the fundamental human rights? For answering these and other questions, we must consider that privacy is not only a legal concept, a social attitude. It has a high symbolic value and meaning too. For many generations of scholars, this symbol was embodied in Mrs. Warren, whose name must not be confused with another Mrs. Warren, the protagonist of a famous George Bernard Shaw's play. She was the wife of a Boston lawyer, Samuel Warren, and like Marcel Proust's Madame Swann, she was living in a worldly kaleidoscope, narrated by some newspapers, the Boston Globe and the Boston Gazette. That was perceived by Samuel Warren as an unbearable intrusion in their private and familial life. He reacted, writing together with Louis Brandeis, afterwards a Supreme Court famous judge, an essay published in the Harvard Law Review in 1890, whose title was The Right to Privacy, and where privacy was defined the right to be let alone. So, in this act of birth of the modern privacy concept, it was identified with the bourgeoisie and begins its ambiguous fortune. Two souls in same body. Conservative tradition journalists among the patricians, such as Samuel Warren, were concerned mainly over the immunities of high society. Liberals among the patricians, such as Louis Brandeis, joined the concern over the privacy of the social prominent with the particular fear that some minorities, the artistically sensitive or intellectually unpopular, would be harmed by press intrusion. If we had to identify a symbol of the privacy of this age, I would like to find it in the first page of a book of an American scholar, Lawrence Friedman, The Republic of Choice. During the very cold winter of 1985, the city of New York responded by issuing an order to pick up all homeless and bring them into municipal shelters by force if necessary. Some homeless refused this intervention, saying, "They can take me unless I do something wrong. We have got rights." This homeless did not accept any intervention in his private sphere and claimed freedom of choice. It means that privacy has changed its meaning and its social justification and perception. If we look at it beyond the extreme homeless world, we can easily discover that privacy has become more and more a legal device against public and private surveillance, classification, discrimination. So it goes far beyond the boundaries of a single class. Now it cannot be identified with the bourgeoisie, with its interest only. It must be regarded as a channel giving ordinary people a general right to informative self-determination, the right to a special protection for sensitive data, the right to control the uses of personal data processed by others. Can we say that privacy has been democratized? If the answer is yes, it does not imply that we can forget how privacy has been built up in modern Western societies. I start with a remark made by Lewis Mumford in his History of the Cities. The first radical change, which was to break down the form of the traditional medieval dwelling, was the development of the feeling of intimacy. The latter, indeed, implied the possibility of isolating oneself at will from the life and occupation in common with one's associates. Intimacy during sleep, intimacy during meals, intimacy during religious and social ritual, finally intimacy of thought, end of quotation. This fact marks, is always Mumford speaking, the end of reciprocal social relations between the upper and the lower classes of a feudal system, relations which had mitigated its oppression. The desire for intimacy marks the beginning of that new ranking of classes, which was to end up in the relentless class struggles and individualistic claims of a later period. End of quotation. In this sense, the birth of privacy can historically be situated at the time of the disintegration of feudal society, where individuals were all linked together by a series of relations reflected in the very organization of their daily life. Isolation was a privilege of a very chosen few or of those who, by birth of choice, lived isolated from the communities, mystics or monks, shepherds or robbers. This possibility then extends to those having the material means to enable them to reproduce, even in a urban environment, conditions which were capable of satisfying the new need for intimacy. And it's well known that this is a process in which multiple factors come into play, from new building technique of houses to the separation between the place of living and the place of work, the private home as opposed to the office. Privacy thus becomes something available to the bourgeois class, which manages to assert itself, especially thanks to the socio-economic transformation related to the Industrial Revolution. It is useless to insist further on the multiple set of conditions which led to development of privacy as a typical right of the bourgeois class, in particular in environmental and social context. The golden era of privacy, for instance, has been identified in the second half of the 19th century in the United States of America. It's important to point out that this was not the outcome of linear development, but of a disruption having occurred in the social organization, as Mumford rightly indicated. The emerging of the material condition for the satisfaction of the need of intimacy appears as a phase of a more complex operation by which the bourgeoisie recognizes its own identity within the social body. The possibility of full enjoying one's intimacy is a feature differentiating the bourgeoisie from the other social classes, and the individualistic component will then enable this operation to turn into an instrument of isolation of each bourgeois within his own class. The bourgeois, in other terms, takes hold of his own space with a technique which reminds one of the action accomplished in order to identify a right of solitary ownership. Thus, at the social and institutional level, the birth of privacy does not appear as the fulfillment of a natural need of all individuals, but as the acquisition of a privilege by a group. It is not by chance that the legal provision protecting this right are main modeled on the characteristic provision of the bourgeois right par excellence, the right of ownership, and that claims similar to those asserted by the bourgeoisie under the label of privacy are either not acknowledged to the working class at all, or else are implemented later by means of completely different legal provisions. The material conditions of life are responsible for excluding privacy for the horizon of the working classes. It is sufficient to consider the data collected, for instance, in England during the past century on the housing situation of the English workers in London, Edinburgh, Bradford, Leeds, and Manchester, in order to realize, by contrast, the elite connotation associated with the concept of privacy. It has rightly been said that poverty and privacy are simply contradictory, that indeed the right to be let alone can acquire a evilly negative meaning when this implies a disregard for the condition of the less wealthy, abandoning the weakest to social violence. That's also the core of the more recent feminist critique to privacy, according which the protection of the privacy of a domestic sphere in which inequality exists is the protection of the right of the strong to exploit and abuse the weak. If we look at the present situation, we can easily discover how situation has changed. Consider, for instance, the legal status of some sensitive data, such as those reflecting political and trade unions' opinions. Generally speaking, those data do not belong only to private sphere, at least in democratic states, they concern also the public sphere. They are part of those convictions which the individual should be able to demonstrate in public. They help to determine his public identity. The fact that this data is to be attributed to the category of sensitive data, having a particular protection against the risk of circulation, derives from their potentially discriminatory use. To guarantee precisely this fullness to the public sphere, rigorous controlled circulation of that information has been decided upon, and they are attributed with a potent private status, certain status and parties. This kind of protection became part of the privacy dimension. And this case shows not only the difficulty to trace precise and definitive boundaries between public and private sphere. It can also deny the opinion of a natural attitude of privacy to be only a factor of social fragmentation, a pure individualistic instrument. On the contrary, it can become a powerful weapon for enlarging the opportunities to be integrated in a democratic society, for giving access to a full citizenship. All these changes are reflected by the changes of the privacy definition. The theoretical discussion and the complex experiences of recent years demonstrate that privacy is by now an extremely dynamic notion, and that a strict constant interrelation exists between changes determined by information technology, but also by reproductive and genetic engineering technology, and conceptual changes. A definition of privacy as the right to be let alone lost its general value long, even if it continues to express an essential aspect of the problem and can be applied to specific situations. Functional definition of privacy tend to prevail in the information society and in different ways refer to the possibility of an individual to know, control, direct, interrupt the information flux which concern him. Therefore, privacy can be defined now more precisely as the right to maintain control of one's own information. At the same time, the notion of private sphere has been enlarged and includes by now situation and interests which were previously excluded from the specific area of juridical protection, of legal protection. We might define the private sphere as the ensemble of actions, behavior, opinions, preferences, personal information, of which the interested party wishes to maintain exclusive control. Consequently, privacy can be identified as the protection of life choices from public control and social disgrace in a framework characterized, in fact, by the freedom of life choices. We are faced with two clear tendencies. On one hand, we are aware of a redefinition of the concept of privacy, which, together with traditional power of exclusion, attributes an ever increasing and clearer relevance to the power of control. On the other hand, the object of the right to reserve is enlarged as a result of the enrichment of the technical notion of private sphere, which includes an ever-growing number of legally relevant situations. With this in mind, when we talk about private, we do not necessarily mean areas to which we attribute a particular protection for motives of secrecy. That notion now tends to cover all those activities and situations in which a person finds himself which have a potential for communication, verbal and nonverbal, and which can thus be translated into information. Private means here personal. It does not necessarily mean secret at all. Taking this statement as a starting point, we might say that today the most relevant sequence is not that of person information circulation secrecy, around which the classical notion of privacy has been built up. He who has the right to privacy can demand forms of controlled circulation, something which goes beyond the mere interruption of the information flow which concerns him. Furthermore, we must look at the privacy also in a perspective in which some other interests, such as the right not to know, are becoming more and more relevant. If the right not to know is accepted, also the way in which privacy is conceived of is influenced. The power of controlling the information which concerns me, which you have seen as characteristic of more up-to-date definition of the right of privacy, is also to be seen as negative power, as the right to exclude for one's own private sphere a certain category of information. For instance, some information about the genetic origin. Privacy is to be specified thus as the right to control the information flow incoming and outgoing concerning a person. This is a tendency which has been confirmed by the first laws with which certain American states have declared as illegal and penally sanctionable the sending of messages via fax against the will or without the permission of the receiver. This is a development corresponding to the technology considered of the right already recognized in many cases of being able to eliminate one's own address or telephone number from directories so as to avoid receiving unwanted communications or materials. At this point, we might specify further the definition of privacy, the right to maintain control of one's own information and decide how to construct one's own private sphere. The object of this right is to be specified and can be identified in the current or potential information patrimony of an individual. So, the context in which the notion of privacy comes to be characterized is that of four tendencies which can be summed up thus. from the right to be left alone to the right to keep control of information which concerns me. Second, from privacy to the right of information self-determination. Third, from privacy to non-discrimination. Fourth, from secrecy to control. For better understanding these trends, we must look to the way in which information and communication technologies have modified the environment in which the problem of privacy arises. They have given other new meanings to privacy. For instance, when the internet is represented as the location of limitless freedom, and when we ask to use it as we wish, autonomously, anonymously, conflicts between individual and collective interests arise. Indeed, the request for a defense of privacy comes not only from those who claim a complete guaranteed protection, extending, if necessary, to anonymity. It is claimed with equal conviction by those who see their privacy violated by those who, maintaining their anonymity, make it impossible or particularly difficult to adopt countermeasures. What happens if one interested party with an acquired identity diffuses reserved or defamatory information concerning another? Does a different identity bring with it the right to invade with impunity another's privacy? How can we resolve the conflict between these contrasting claims to privacy, one active, the other passive, both of which lead to the free construction of an individual private sphere? Reflection on these technologies on a wider scale have more to do with the way in which the informative infrastructure is generally planned and then set up. Up to now, this has never included the dimension of citizenship, and therefore it has been conceived of as an instrument for the gathering and treatment of the largest possible amount of information. Now, once more, we are faced with an urgent alternative. Will the digital age be a period in which individuals lose all control over personal information, or does the digital age offer a renewed opportunity for privacy? A convincing answer can be provided only if our starting point is the premise that everybody must have the right to self-determination, from which the necessity for reinforcement of those powers derives and which can be effectively and directly exercised by each person. And this depends not only on the setting up of rules, but also on the architecture which different systems assume. Indeed, in recent years, we have witnessed an erosion of the power of information concerning the self. Intensive, radical forms of fragmentation. This is the result of an ever wider and more specialized diffusion of personal information by a variety of parties who displace the self in diversified, undetermined, elusive locations. Considering this data as indispensable for the information society, believing that the full protection of personal information too high a price to pay is an attitude which is not only unilateral, but contradicted by tendencies retraceable to the entrepreneurial dimension itself, where initiatives aimed at reassuring the users of information and communication technologies are beginning to appear by means of behavioral codes, sector directives, different forms of self-discipline. Thus, the protection of privacy offers itself also a way of socially legitimizing those technologies. However, at the same time, the tendency puts us on our guard against excessive simplification of the problem of personal information, because it's precisely here that we find the borderline between the information and society, that of surveillance. Once more, questions concerning the overall private and public spheres are interwoven. It's mistaken to maintain that techniques of gathering personal information with a pervasive and granular nature produce relevant effects only in the area of that behavior which is linked to economic activity. While in fact the awareness is growing among users of ease which every trace of their navigating in internet can be found, the tendency to intervene in discussion and activities with a strong political relevance can cool. What therefore is erased, or at least seriously reduced, is precisely that vocation for enriching citizen participation which offers itself habitually as the most relevant contribution with information and communication technologies can offer to the democratic process. The description of the new technological landscape and the transformation it brings with it is thus not a concluded discussion, but merely the path to be followed to reach a full comprehension of the social effects of information and communication technologies. And these effects specifically concern privacy, but not exclusively it, can be summed up in the following way. We have gone from a world in which personal information was essentially under the almost exclusive control of the interested party to a world of shared information with a plurality of subjects. We have gone from a world in which the only problem was that of control the outward flux of information from inside the private sphere towards the outside, to a world in which the control of information entering is becoming ever more important, as is shown by the growing importance of the right not to know, by the attribution to a single individual of the power of refusing interference in their private sphere. We have gone from a world in which information were collected through personal relationships to a world where data are collected through abstract transactions. We are living in a world in which the added value of personal information is growing, with a paradigm change where the reference to the value in itself of the person and his dignity becomes secondary compared to the transformation of information into goods. We are living in a world in which an awareness is being acquired that it is necessary to reflect on the fact that up to now, information and communication technologies have all too often taken on the characteristics of dirty technologies, resembling the polluting industrial technologies, so that it has become essential to encourage or impose the introduction of clean technologies into the information environment. We are living, finally, in a world in which it's precisely in information and communication technologies which have helped to make ever more transient the boundary between the public and private spheres, and the possibility of constructing a private sphere and the autonomous development of the personality have become condition for achieving effectiveness of freedom in the public sphere. But how must we deal with the problem of the construction of the private sphere in an environment dominated more and more by the information and communication technologies, in which data are more and more transactional data, processed by many and many public and private agencies? Our personal information are at the same times in dozens of electronic data banks. We are becoming multiplied persons, abstractions in the cyberspace, with dramatic changes in the construction of the identity, in the perception of the self. Identity is no more the well-rounded sphere described already by the Greek philosopher Parmenides. In the world of the electronic data banks, when we are navigating on internet, the self is fragmented, divided. The divided self explodes in the net. Identity can change continuously. It is not an element of stability in the social context. It leads rather to the possibility of nomadism in the electronic universe. But the multiplication of the person can be an effect of an individual choice and decision, or of the logic of the market forces. Entering the net, I can change my identity, choosing anonymity or a representation of myself in the virtual world completely different from those of the real world. When you are online, people say, you can be anything you want to be. As an electronic person, I can decide to be an adult, rich, white man inside of a young, poor, black woman, for not to be discriminated against, and on the contrary, be accepted and legitimized in the virtual community. But is it a true form of liberation of the person from some heavy social constraints, or on the contrary, we surrender to the force of stereotypes, we accept the logic of social stigmatization? However, net gives the people a continuous possibility of changing identity. Everyone can be one, none, known 100,000 as the protagonist of novel of an Italian writer, Luigi Pirandello, and the multiple windows on the computer become the representation of the divided self. But the multiplier the person can be the consequence of the way in which market uses personal information. I say that we are in dozens data banks. Insurance, credit card companies, direct marketing organization, credit agencies, and so on. If we look at the problem from this point of view, we can easily discover that this multiplication of the person does not mean that we can find the same person in the various data banks. In each of these banks, we found only a fragment of our identity according to the specific function of that data bank. So, in a place I can be only a consumer of some goods and services, in another one a scientist, in another one the lover of a certain kind of movies, and so on. How to reconstruct the whole identity of a person? Are we needing a true right to identity? The answer can be affirmative if we look at the rules of many privacy laws, where it is forbidden to take decisions on an individual on the sole basis of automated profiles, and each person has the right to integrate the personal information collected and processed by a single data bank. But looking to the way in which market forces multiply persons, we discover also that the data collection has a logic which differs deeply for the aims of the traditional forms of data collection by some public bodies, such as behave in a way socially considered unacceptable. It leads to a surveillance society. On the contrary, the market-oriented data banks use personal information for inducing individuals to repeat some acts in the area of the consumption. It's rather a society of classification, potentially no less dangerous of the surveillance society. In fact, if my personal or familial profile does not correspond to some prevailing market profiles, I could be discriminated against. So a new problem of minorities protection rises. How can we give all people the guarantee that they can have access to all goods and services directly connected with the development of their personality? And this answer becomes more and more dramatic when we discover that on the side of the demand, there is the continuous opening of new channels to access goods and services. But on the side of the offer, there is a continuous concentration of powers in the hands of few giant corporations. At the same time, in this dimension, personal information are more and more necessary for the market operation. Personal data become a commodity with a high added value. So, if we are our data, as people say, the personal itself becomes a commodity. The social and political electronic space of individual and groups can become like New York described by Herman Melville at the beginning of Moby Dick. Commerce surrounds it with her surf. At the same time, the fact that we are living in a more and more interconnected world does not give only new opportunities for individuals and groups to have access to information, to exchange experiences, to make wider the public debate, to invent new forms of participation. There is also a new strong pressure at national, supranational level to control the mobility of citizens in the cyberspace and in the real space through forms of censorship in internet and controls on the migration flows through international exchanges of personal information. So, protecting privacy becomes a precondition for achieving a full citizenship. If privacy and anonymity are not safeguarded, the result is a chilling effect that can induce individuals, the data subjects, to gradually discard their fundamental rights. In other words, a democratic society is also a society that deliberately renounces to information, even where it's technically possible to obtain them. It's true for public and private bodies. It shows now how public and private spheres are deeply interconnected. Democracy means also not to be reduced as citizens to object of the market activities, to numbered voices for polls, to people stimulated by emotional answers through the so-called electronic instant referenda. More dramatically than in the past, we are facing the problem of the autonomy of the individual and of the polity, and more generally of the autonomy of an individual and social space free from the pressure of the pure logic of the market or by new demands of social control. We cannot accept that the promise of information and communication technologies will be converted into a source of inequality and restriction of civil and political rights. The road to equality starts from a set of new rights that must guarantee free speech, self-construction of the private sphere, protection against social and market pressure, adequate forms of social integration. Starting from this point and from a broad privacy concept as freedom to construct both private and public sphere, we can indicate some basic condition for an electronic citizenship. A universal public information service at no cost or with low cost connectivity. A non-commercial space for giving the possibility to create communities which can reinforce the social linkage and not only the separation of interest, and experimentation mainly at local level, for instance in the community networks and through the new project on electronic town meetings and deliberative polls, conceived as an alternative to the traditional polls, so we could avoid the risk of a plebiscitarian populism of the hyper-democracy, as Ortega y Gasset said. on this road to electronic citizenship, we encounter 3P: property, pornography, privacy. It means that we need at least completely new antitrust policies for reducing the influence of the economic power. Adequate guarantees for free speech, freedom to build up the private sphere without constraints, looking at the privacy in the framework of the citizenship, that means as a right and not as a commodity. So, broadly conceived as freedom to construct both private and public sphere, privacy becomes one of the preconditions of the democratic process. Along this road, we cannot expect gifts like kings did in the last century with the octroyé constitutions. Powerful forces inside information and communication technology push towards more social control, more concentration of powers. So the electronic citizenship can be only the result of multiple efforts, of a difficult day-by-day work of a crowd of motivated citizens in a framework built up also by conscious public powers. That's the challenge, not for the future, but for today. Thank you for your attention.
This was a brilliant analysis. Thank you very much, Professor Rodotin, for your fascinating account of the legal concept, of the social structure, and of the historical transformation of the concept of privacy. I think it's also very much in time. It's a good moment to hear a talk about this right now, because in this country we have this explosive debate right now on the Bill of Rights being incorporated and raising especially the issue of the right to privacy and the question how it will be developed and by what institution. There are secondly the spectacular accounts of intrusion of the press into privacy, and thirdly the internet. So there's a lot to talk about in this context here. Coming back to this question of Bill of Rights, there's a debate raging here about the question not only what kind of content such a right of privacy should have, but also which institutions are the most apt one, the most suited ones to develop this law of privacy. And the debate is of course between the judiciary and the parliament. And I wonder if you also could have some comments from your experience on this, because is it true that there are structural deficiencies on the side of politics, on the side of parliaments, which make it somewhat inept to do this task due to this double problem of once being involved, being a victim of all this, but secondly also being very close to the press and perhaps being too much under the influence, like in the cases of apportionment of election districts. But similarly, the judiciary might have their structural deficiencies, case by case development. Is this the right way to follow such a comprehensive and complicated issue? And secondly, if the judiciary does it, will this not lead to rather narrow forms of legal protection, basically via subjective rights, as we Europeans say, and the right to litigation, but not institutions like ombudspersons and so on? And of course, the comparative dimension. And you introduced this as a kind of universal problem, coming with the techno society, the techno state. But I also would wonder about the cultural diversities in this process. Is there something to a cultural peculiarity of, let's say, English individualism versus Italian individualism that would create a different approach to questions of privacy, or are we just exposed to the one, the same technological imperative, which then also asks for the same solutions? So perhaps this might be two introductory questions, if you want to react to this, and then we open the floor to the debate in general.
The problem of Bill of Rights, and more generally speaking, of the right way to deal with the new demands of how protect fundamental rights, it's a very difficult question. I think that cultural diversity leads to different solutions. But in this very moment, looking at the problem of privacy, at European level, we have a new approach commanded but by the directive of the European Union on data banks and the protection of personal data and other minor but important directives like the directive on the service by phone and so on. It leads, in my opinion, to a complex framework in which we have to deal with some general principles. And it's interesting to look at the first article of the directive because it reflects an interest evolution of the same concept of privacy. Article 1 of the directive says, member states shall protect the fundamental rights and freedom of natural person, and in particular, their right to privacy with respect to the processing of personal data. Interpreting this rule, we can see that the protection of personal data is not related only to privacy protection. It's first is connected with the fundamental rights and freedoms. This is the first reference for data protection. It means that Europe at European level, we must have a common core, a unique set of general principles, and there is room for the activity of judiciary and for the supervisory authorities, the so-called independent authorities in this area, independent commission committed with protection of personal data. A third level indicated by the directive and reflected in the first law passed, enacted after the directive, like the Italian and Greek ones, is the level of the codes of conduct, the self-regulation in this area. So, the legal machinery can be considered as the result of an integrated strategy involving as subject not only the traditional producer of legal rules, the parliament, but the judiciary, the so-called independent administrative bodies, the society interested, because code of conducts may be the result of the self-regulation of some areas in which are active, for instance, journalists, very controversial issue, and for instance, the areas like internet, where The problem of rules is now under scrutiny of the subject economically directly involved in this area. The providers, the people governing websites, the people offering goods and services in websites, they are now offering and sometimes code of conduct giving protection to privacy. They sell and at the same time services, goods, and privacy. This is another dimension, because excluding privacy for this area can be a disincentive to the use of these services, to the use of this, this new electronic perspective dimension as internet. If you are not sure that your the number of your credit card will be protected, you cannot use this kind of device. So I think that the first problem, I am not sure, I am not, in this area it's very difficult to have an answer, a very sharp answer. I think that we have to work at these three levels: legislative principles, intervention of judiciary and administrative bodies, self-regulation. And it's important, the integration of these three levels, because it's very, very difficult to use the traditional legislative technique, because the traditional legislative technique was the final answer to a conflict. The parliament was resolving a conflict. Conflict was solved by the parliament. Now we are dealing with reality in continuous change, and we need flexibility also at the level of legal regulation. Working in the framework of general principles coming from the parliament, coming from constitutions, it's coming from the convention at supranational level, we can have at the same time some indications and at the same time the possibility to use this indication in a flexible way through the power of adaptation of judiciary, administrative bodies, codes of conduct. I don't know if this
Thank you. I invite now questions, comments, critique. Self-regulatory approaches, fragmentations of personalities.
No, this is not an easy question to answer. First of all, we are now dealing with a case not inside European Union, but outside European Union. And the directive I quoted, there is a rule effective already in some countries like Italy and Greece, forbidding the transmission of information, of personal information, to institutions, private public bodies in other countries where there is no adequate protection, comparable protection. The first problem, which is worrying Americans, is what means adequate protections. So I, in recent conference on privacy in Montreal, there was a lady, an American lady, going to the floor and saying, please, you, the European, must not transfer medical data in United States because your data will be circulating freely from doctors to insurance companies to pharmaceutical companies and so on. This is the first problem. If for that kind of data we can find the same level of protection. It will be a rule for all Europe starting October 98, where the directive must be enforced in all the countries of the European Union. Second problem is we are now, the problem is that there is a judiciary injunction. This is judiciary asking for this data. And the problem is, if we look at it's difficult for me to give an answer at the international level, because generally speaking, this kind of order, not in all cases, are mandatory for the subject in the other state. And they answer according their national laws. This is the problem. If there is no consent, previous consent, or special consent given by the data subject, the answer is you cannot give my personal data, my economic data. But the exception is if, for instance, the Italian subject say, I must diffuse this data for the, there is a contract between me and the data subject. And this data, the diffusion of this data is necessary for the development of the contractual relation. It's possible to disclose data also without the consent of the data subject. We need a cautious analysis of the case.
Are there other questions, comments? No.
I think that's one of the crucial issues of the so-called information society. I have seen research by the Rand Society. I am looking through this book. There are the figures. But in any case, in the last 10 years, the distance between the haves and have-nots in this area has dramatically increased. I don't say that is the trends for the near future of for the next 50 years, but in this very moment, it means that if we are confident also in the spontaneous evolution, it means that the consequence can be new inequalities. We have a problem. Some people cannot be persons in this new dimension because they are not enough wealthy, because they have not enough culture, because they are not a problem of culture. The problem, one of the very important problems in this very moment, is literacy. We are living in more dramatically the problem of literacy in the last century, or in this century in many countries. The access to the democratic process was people who had not enough literacy were excluded from democratic process. They cannot vote. Now we have not this kind of exclusion. If you are not able to use computer, if you are not able to navigate in internet, you are formally excluded from the democratic, from the political process. But in any case, it's what is happening now, or can happen in near future, if this channel will be the channel where the debate, a more active debate will develop. Because now the people are, as part of the information society, more spectators than actors, because they are seeing at the TV debate. This is one of the great channels for the political information, but it's a passive role of the people. If we look at internet and to the rhetoric of internet, we say that it's possible a more not only interactive, but active participation in the process. If I have not the skills, if I have not enough money, I cannot participate in this kind of active citizenship. I share your concerns. I think that this new dramatic division between haves and have-nots can be one of the factors of growing inequalities in our society, and it needs conscious public policies. It's not enough to say market forces, evolution of technologies will be self-regulating this issue. It was an illusion at the beginning of the era of the age of computers. A distinguished scholar, Paul Barron, it was not a conservative, on the contrary, but he said that these technologies had an enormous self-regulating power, and this area, the new area in which the electronic technologies were working, did not need any legal rules. If now you look at what happened, in fact, you can find a library of an enormous amount of books collecting law, rules, and so on, only for protecting privacy. I think that some conscious public policies are needed in this area.
Well, I think it's the privacy of the senior commons room which is now demanding its right and asking for a more private discussion, at least the continuation of this public one. I would like to thank Professor Rodotar for his passionate engagement in both the lecture and discussion. Thank you very much. Senior commons room reception now, fifth floor.